You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
If you were to measure things based upon the amount of outrage and the amount of sometimes panic that one witnesses on the campus of the average college or university, you would think that, well, we were back in the dark days of the 1950s when it comes to racism on campus, or the dark days of the 1940s when it comes to sexism on campus. The picture is painted, and often painted, even from within the administration of these universities themselves, that they are, whether it's Harvard or Yale or your local state university, they are hotbeds of sexism, of homophobia, of racism. How is that picture painted, and why, and is that picture accurate? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about diversity ideology on American university campuses. Joining us to do so on this Monday afternoon, Heather McDonald, Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributor to City Journal, and author of several books, including her latest, The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. Heather, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it.
You have coined the term diversocrat. What does it mean?
A diversocrat is a diversity bureaucrat whose sole purpose in life is to perpetuate the poisonous diversity ideology on campuses and increasingly in the corporate world that holds that the most important thing about a person is his gonads and melanin, and the discrimination based on those contingent characteristics is the most pervasive and important characteristic of American society today.
You have had personal experience in very recently in 2017 with the product of this diversity ideology in American colleges and universities. Talk about your experience at Claremont McKenna College and UCLA.
Well, I'd been invited by students at both schools. Actually, at Claremont McKenna, I was invited by a academic center there to talk about my book, The War on Cops, which argues that the Black Lives Matter narrative about policing is not true. The Black Lives Matter narrative says that we're living through an epidemic of racially biased police shootings of black males, and that policing is also endemically, systemically racist. And my book, through data and talking to law-abiding members of the black community, says that's not true. There's not an epidemic of bias shootings, and there's a huge unrecognized support for the police in high-crime communities. Well, when word got out at Claremont McKenna, which is a small liberal arts college in Southern California to the east of Los Angeles, that I would be speaking, a call went out on Facebook to shut the fascist, or I should say the effing fascist, down and not give me a platform to speak. And on the day of the talk, I had been brought on campus and put in what was in essence a safe house, and I could hear all around me, though I couldn't see, it wasn't in my range of vision, the mob growing louder and louder, drumming, chanting. You know, it sounded really like something you'd hear maybe the French Revolution, or just, you know, the the problem of crowds when they become overtaken by an irrational hatred and fear. So I was taken into the place where I was supposed to speak, again through a secret passageway with police escort. What I didn't know was that outside the auditorium, about 250 protesters had circled it in order to prevent anybody from entering the auditorium to hear me speak, and they were successful. They blocked anybody from coming in, faculty included. The campus police, typical in the Black Lives Matter era, where cops are terrified of using any kind of lawful force lest it be caught on cell phone and go on the CNN 24-hour loop of racist cops, they just stood by passively and let these student mobsters take over. So I gave my speech to an empty hall, and there were law enforcement members inside the hall. At some point, they decided that the students who were outside pounding on the plate glass windows and screaming were too dangerous, and they couldn't guarantee my safety any longer. So my talk was cut off, and I was escorted through the kitchen into a waiting police car and taken to the Claremont Police Department. At the previous night at University of California, Los Angeles, I'd been invited that time by the College Republicans to talk about my book, and the Antifa types did allow me to get through the first part of my talk, but when I finished that part, they stormed the stage and grabbed the microphones and tried to control everything for about 10 minutes of shouting. And, you know, I would try to answer their claims, and they would start chanting and shouting back. So there, the university ignored this completely. At Claremont, eventually, there was some discipline meted out to about 7 of the 300 students, which is sounds like not much, but it's more than any other campus has done, which to other speakers who have been shouted down, or in the case of Charles Murray at Middlebury, a fellow professor or a professor there was given a concussion, the students were so violent, nothing happened to those students at Middlebury. So the typical response of campus administrators and these diversocrats is just to look the other way.
How do you understand the kind of the quick descent into vulgarity? You mentioned kind of chanting and eventually violence. How do you understand that?
Well, I wouldn't say it's quick. I would say it's been going on for 30, 40 years. It was, we saw in the 1960s with black radicals taking over campus buildings, holding presidents hostage, using bombs, using violence. And again, the campus adults were utterly passive and cowardly in the face of that. There was sort of a lull in the violence in the 70s, 80s, and to a certain extent the 90s. But in the meantime, what was happening was the perfection of this identity politics and diversity ideology, which teaches students to hate the greatest works of Western civilization and to hate each other, to think of themselves in the mutually exclusive categories of oppressed, which is the big status category to be on a college campus today, or oppressor. And if you're a white male, you heterosexual white male, you are by definition an oppressor. And the only way you can escape that pariah status is to declare yourself an ally. And so your life is supposed to be spent on colleges protecting the oppressed from oppression. That ideology now has just a massive, again, it has massive bureaucratic clout behind it. At UCLA, their vice chancellor for equity, diversity, and inclusion is paid over $400,000 a year. That is many multiple times the salary of junior faculty at UCLA. He does nothing. There is nothing for him to do because the college faculties are not racist and they are not sexist. They are the most tolerant individuals in human history for societies, traditionally marginalized groups. But these diversity bureaucrats sit around cooking up new ways to indoctrinate their students in their sensation of oppression. And so we just have reached a critical mass now where this very, very dangerous ideology has not only destroyed humanistic learning on campuses, but it's now very rapidly spreading into society at large.
What is the proper purpose of a university in educating our young people?
The proper purpose of a university is to pass on an inheritance. It's a transaction between one generation and the new generation. This is something that the British philosopher Michael Oakeshott has written about very movingly and persuasively. It should be an act of gratitude, of joy, of ecstasy at encountering works of such sublimity and grandeur that none of us mere fallible mortals are likely to come close in our own lives to being able to replicate, and giving students a proper appreciation for the long, patient development of civilization that gave rise to their freedoms. It's not about political indoctrination, and I would say it's also not really about politics. You know, I actually don't think I should be invited to college campuses, not because I'm a white supremacist homophobe, which I'm not, but because I speak of things of the moment. You know, speaking about Black Lives Matter, that's a thing of the moment. College is 4 precious years to encounter the greatest works that have ever been created, and that's what should be the focus.
We're talking with Heather McDonald, author of several books, including her latest, The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. When we come back, I wonder if she has run across any university faculty who are regretfully saying, we've created a monster.
This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we are committed to our Lutheran confession and heritage. Please encourage the student in your life to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Today's Puritans aren't the Pilgrims. Today's Puritans are progressives.
Ryan Anderson, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so the new form of the Puritan mistake, my co-author Sharif Gerges and I have called it progressive Puritanism. These are people who want to force Roman Catholic nuns to pay for contraception. They want to force evangelical bakers to create custom wedding cakes for same-sex weddings. They now want to force Catholic hospitals to perform sex reassignment surgeries and to perform hormone therapy, testosterone therapy on women who want to identify as men. They're the ones trying to shut down faith-based, including Lutheran adoption agencies.
You can listen to Ryan Anderson's presentation, Making the Case for Our First Freedoms, and all of the speakers from our 2018 conferences on an audio DVD or thumb drive. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300. Order today at issuesetc.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Monday, November the 19th, we're talking about diversity ideology on American university and college campuses. Heather McDonald, author of the book Diversity Delusion, is our guest. Heather, I'm wondering, have you found any faculty on university campuses who may have contributed, who may have helped create the current atmosphere there, who might be saying now we've created a monster?
Well, that's an interesting, complicated question, and one does wonder, because it's not as if at this point this mob violence is limited to alleged conservatives like myself. It's now turning on card-carrying members of the progressive liberals, if not the left. One of the most outrageous instances of the student Yahooism occurred at Yale in 2015 in the fall, where at least 100 minority Yale students surrounded a highly respected progressive sociologist and screamed and cursed at him for 3 hours because his wife had dared to send around an email to students suggesting that Yale students were capable of choosing their own Halloween costumes free from the tender mercies of Yale's diversity bureaucrats. Having done so, then turned her husband into a pariah. And the husband, who was subjected to this three-hour expletive-filled tirade where people were saying, "You are disgusting. Who hired you? You know, get the F out of here." These are Yale students saying this to a professor. This professor, Nicholas Christakis, is a lifelong liberal, if not left-winger, he and his wife have devoted themselves to social justice. Same thing happened at Evergreen State College, one of the most radical schools in the country. A biologist there, who is also a man of the left, got another one of these school tirades because he had declined to follow the mandate of Evergreen's diversity bureaucracy to stay off campus for a day because he was white. This was something that all of the white people on campus, students and faculty, had been ordered to do to pay penance for their whiteness. And this biology professor, Brett Weinstein, said, "I don't think so. You know, this is a purely racial discrimination. I'm not going to go along with this." So this subjected Weinstein to 3 hours of hate. And Weinstein was forced to resign along with his wife. His wife has taken to being, and she also, very, very progressive, has become a critic of the campus identity politics. But you do wonder whether, more broadly, people are taking responsibility and understanding that they have created a monster. It is always the big question, and it's always, I have to admit, one feels a certain amount of schadenfreude when left-wing people are accused of racism. And you wonder, well, do they say to themselves, "Well, I know that I'm not a racist, and yet I am accused of being one for some sort of bland support of due process or free speech. So I wonder if that means that the people whom I myself have accused of racism over the years, maybe that was an unjust accusation." I don't know the answer to that, but one can only hope it's happening.
The Brett Weinstein case is interesting because he was obviously dealing with a more classical liberal understanding of tolerance and diversity, and seemed unaware, blissfully unaware, that his students had an entirely different definition of those two terms. How would you describe what diversity means in cases like that?
Well, what it means for the campus radicals and their faculty and administrative enablers is, again, it's a concept that is fundamentally rooted to the idea of ubiquitous discrimination. And so it means nothing other than race, gender, and one of the 116 and rapidly metastasizing categories of gender identity that students are coming up with to try and come up with ever new ways of being victims. So for them, you know, diversity is just a way of further attacking Western civilization. It's often pointed out, and to me at this point it's kind of hackneyed to do so, but I guess it needs to be stated again, that what is not meant by diversity on campus is ideological or political diversity.
So when someone is referred to on the university campus as a racist, it sounds like that is not a very difficult bar to cross. What qualifies one as a racist under that definition?
Oh, it's so true. What qualifies for being a racist is saying that there's value in studying Plato and Aristotle and Kant, that studying those authors will not subject the students to life-threatening bigotry, which is what is the received wisdom among the students and their diversity enablers. And it means that saying that racism is not the most persuasive or sort of as a just a analytic matter, efficient way to describe or to explain the ongoing socioeconomic disparities. So if you say anything about behavioral disparities, cultural disparities that contribute, if not create at this point entirely, some of the racial socioeconomic disparities, that makes you a racist. I write in the book about a University of Pennsylvania law professor, Amy Wax, who co-authored an op-ed with a law professor from San Diego Law School, saying that bourgeois values would be the best solution to poverty today. Personal responsibility, not having children out of wedlock, deferring gratification, not getting involved in drugs and alcohol, abusing them. And this op-ed has turned her into a pariah. Her dean has banned her from teaching first-year law classes because after writing the op-ed, she did a video interview with a black Brown University economist named Glenn Lowry, and the University of Pennsylvania law professor Amy Wax broke a very large taboo and talked about the fact that black law students at University of Pennsylvania, having been admitted with very large racial preferences, meaning that they were admitted with much, much lower academic test scores and LSATs, didn't do well. They clustered at the bottom of their class, which is true in every selective college and professional school today. This is something called mismatch, which I write about in the book. For saying that, Wax is has been banned from teaching first-year law classes because it's assumed she's such a racist. The dean who banned her he's accused her of lying without ever giving the actual facts. If she's lying, let us know. Tell how many blacks have graduated in the top of their class. And she is a pariah on campus. I mean, most of her fellow faculty will not even speak to her.
Heather McDonald is our guest, author of The Diversity Delusion. We're talking about diversity ideology on America's university campus. When we come back, the campus rape industry.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian, but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. This child, Jesus Christ, is the focus of every Christmas card that Emmanuel Press offers. Whether in stained glass, illumination, or classic works of art, Christmas cards from Emmanuel Press joyfully confess our Savior's birth with the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to create a custom assortment of cards. EmmanuelPress.us.
We're talking about diversity ideology on the American College and University campus on this Monday afternoon. Heather McDonald is our guest. She is author of several books, including her latest, The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. Heather, what is what you call the campus rape industry?
Well, this is another huge bureaucracy that is devoted to the myth that colleges today are scenes of epidemic levels of sexual violence and rape. So you have this massive bureaucracy that just grows constantly, supposedly to support rape survivors. You've had these bureaucratic tribunals that were vastly unfair. Our Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, recently issued a proposed rule that would try to introduce some due process fairness to those campus rape tribunals. But the underlying claim that there's an epidemic of campus rape going on is simply preposterous. The typical statistics that we hear is that 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 females on a college campus are going to be the victims of sexual assault during the time that they're there. That's a crime level that is unheard of. If that were the case, if these statistics that are thrown around willy-nilly by the campus rape bureaucracy were the case, you would have seen a movement to create single-sex schools decades ago. Instead, what you have is highly educated baby boomer millennial mothers desperately trying to get their daughters into college. You know, in Manhattan, highly educated mothers pay $200 an hour to tutor their toddlers for pre-kindergarten schools in the hope of getting them into Harvard 12 years later. Harvard, which likes to declare itself as a outpost of campus rape, meaning that it too is perpetrating this epidemic. You know, we're supposed to believe that we have strong women together and the sisterhood looks out for itself. If that were the case, you know, why aren't girls telling each other, don't go to that frat party, you're going to get raped? Instead, I can guarantee you on every campus Saturday nights, especially on the party school campuses, the co-eds are trooping off to the frat parties in high heels, spaghetti straps, short skirts, into what is we're supposed to believe is a maelstrom of campus violence. Either the females are too stupid to take protective measures and not put themselves voluntarily into scenes of epidemic levels of violence, or that violence is not going on. And to me, it's quite obvious that it is not going on.
Is that, you talked about, and you talk in your book about the connection between what is happening and has been happening there on college and university campuses, and then it finds its way into American business, it finds its way into society. Is that rape myth that's perpetuated by these bureaucracies, is that the origin of the Me Too movement in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, the Kavanaugh hearings was a... We were all in Gender Studies 101, you know. Now, you know, there has been cases within the Me Too movement of clear abuse of power. Obviously, Harvey Weinstein is an example of that, although even some of the criminal case against him is unraveling here in New York. But whatever justification there was for some sort of accountability for people in positions of power in employment situations who exploited that power for their own sexual gratification. As you suggest, the origin of that is really more this idea that to be male is by definition to be a rapist and to be part of a patriarchy and to think of females as oppressed, which is completely ridiculous. I have never been discriminated against in my life. To the contrary, I've been the so-called beneficiary of gender preferences and quotas for most of my life when feminism became the dominant ideology from the 80s onwards. So the way that the Me Too movement has now quickly grown into simply a way of trying to take males down. I mean, I see it now basically as a attack on civilization perceived as too white and too male.
When does the sheer economics of the situation catch up? I'm thinking about the University of Missouri that was the origin of the Black Lives Matter movement. And in 2015, their enrollment plummeted after that got national coverage. They were forced to cut, I believe at the time, 185 jobs there, and I don't think they've bounced back. At some point, don't regents and administrators at universities say this is hurting us?
Well, first of all, the origin of the Black Lives Matter movement was not at University of Missouri, but the student protests in 2015 on campuses across the country. That was part of the University of Missouri thing. I don't know if even that it's spun off, but it was a high publicity case where the president of the University of Missouri was fired for allegedly tolerating a racist environment on campus. Again, ludicrous. I mean, there's University of Missouri or any place else is not discriminating against blacks. They are admitting blacks with lower qualifications because they want them so badly. You know, and it's absolutely right that Missouri has experienced a drop-off in enrollment. I would like to believe that the marketplace will take care of it, but I think in more prestigious schools that parents are so desperate to credentialize their kids with the most high-status degree they can get, and alumni keep funneling billions of dollars into these schools, that it just does not seem that there's a lot of corrective. There should be. I mean, the reason, if your listeners want to know why tuition is so obscenely expensive, look no further than these diversocrats. At many colleges now, you have a one-to-one ratio of administrators to faculty, all for based on a fiction, which is that schools are racist and sexist. So there should be an accounting. But, you know, this madness has been going on for 30, 40 years, and it just gets worse. And the outside world, and what worries me the most, and I talk about this, is the diversity ideology now entering the STEM fields, which the naive may have thought would have been permanently exempt from putting gender and race ahead of scientific qualifications. But no, that's not the case. Every physics department, every engineering department, every math department in the country is under both internal and external pressure to treat being female as a qualification for being a physicist or being an underrepresented minority, a qualification for being a doctor. So standards are being lowered. Education is being slowed down to try and graduate more females or underrepresented minorities. And that is also hitting the corporate world. I mean, as you mentioned, the HR departments have been taken over by this. And Silicon Valley is completely obsessed with the diversity ideology. Now, they've got, obviously, a huge competitive edge at this point over China. But eventually, China, which remains ruthlessly meritocratic and doesn't give a damn about the gender or melanin count of its engineers, will catch up, because we are diverting so many billions and billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer funding and private funding that could be going into trying to cure Alzheimer's disease or come up with the next engineering advance into this phony diversity crusade. And it's really, really going to drag our competitive edge at risk, drag it down, rather.
Finally, with about 30 seconds here, Heather, what would you say to parents who are preparing to send a child off to a university? What word of warning and caution would you give them?
To try to find courses that will expose them to the best that has been thought and written, to avoid, if at all possible, which is hard because schools have these diversity course requirements that make you do these victimology courses, but if possible, to avoid anything with studies at the end of its departmental name. But I would not say avoid the humanities. I mean, one solution is, well, people think, well, I'll just do engineering or economics. See if you can find any courses in literature and philosophy and history that are not politicized, and take advantage of them. But do not allow yourself to be browbeaten into this victim ideology, whether thinking of yourself as a victim, as a female, or accepting the idea that if you're a male, you are need to pay penance somehow.
Heather McDonald is Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor of City Journal, author of several books, including her latest, The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Heather, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Teachings by Anthony Esselin, author of Out of the Ashes, Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute, and others are featured on a recording of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. We will send you an audio DVD or a flash drive for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300 to Issues, etc. Order online at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385, a recording of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. In Hour 2 of Issues, etc., we'll be introducing the Book of Joel with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.